Welcome to the History of North America. I'm Mark Vinette. The Aztec power was centered at its capital, supported by many tributary city-states. The Aztecs left rulers of conquered enemies in power so long as they agreed to pay semi-annual tribute, as well as supply military forces when needed for the Aztec war efforts. In return, the imperial authority offered protection and political stability, and facilitated an integrated economic network of diverse lands and peoples who had significant local autonomy. The 1521 conquest of Mexico from the Aztecs by Spanish conquistadors is addressed from a wide variety of historical points of view, opinions, interpretations, and presentation styles by past and present authors, historians, and commentators. Let's take a brief look back at the last stand of the Aztec with historian Victor Davis Hanson.
It's very odd for me to see a lot of the romance that surrounds the Aztecs, especially in the Mexican-American community, when they have other indigenous peoples like the Tlaxcalan. While the Tlaxcalan engage in human sacrifice, they did not institutionalize on a continental scale mass death like the Aztecs, and they rebelled against it. And you would think that that would be a more suitable ancestor to choose if you were going to romanticize pre-Columbian Mexico. The invasion of Mexico from the Caribbean at Veracruz and the march inland between 1519 and 1521 by sort of lesser nobility, nobleman Hernan Cortez. He's a very interesting guy. He'd left in his teens to the New World, and then he'd been in Cuba under the Velazquez governorship for a number of years. And then he raised the money, and he had heard of fabulous wealth and a fabulous civilization in the inland of Mexico. But although there had been people who had seen it, nobody quite believed it. So he had almost no information. So he sailed the short distance from Cuba to Veracruz, and he prepared to march inland. And he did. He had about 1,100 men, and the famous story that he burned his ships because it was either, you know, success or failure, but not retreat. And so the thing to remember about his conquest was it was probably absolutely impossible. We have Bernal Diaz's firsthand account, among other later accounts. So pretty much what happened, we have, at least from the Spanish point of view, there were two requisites. You had to have a military genius who had really no military experience to speak of before, like Hernan Cortez, who's a larger-than-life figure of Themistocles and his cunning and his ruthlessness as well. And then you could not have destroyed an empire of 4 million people had not you had the Tlaxcalans and the Tabascans and a whole series of the Totonacs, indigenous people who had been subject to Aztec oppression. And by subject, I mean they, in various wars of rebellion and unification on the part of the Aztecs, their people had been enslaved and brought to Tenochtitlan, Mexico City, and then sacrificed, human sacrificed in a horrific fashion. So there was a great hatred of the Aztec Empire. And Cortez manipulated that brilliantly. So even on the initial assault or entry, he had 1,000 Tlaxcalans with him. And then he went in and he had a very good propaganda that only a person that had horses or these huge Mastiff hunting dogs or Spanish steel blades or Spanish armor, highest quality steel in Europe, or gunpowder, or cannons, or this strange language, or these priests, with all of that had to be beyond the comprehension of Montezuma and the Aztecs, and therefore had to have a divinity element in it. And there had been reports how they got there to Veracruz. People in the Native American community had transmitted village to village that people had arrived on these godlike ships that had sails, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, anybody would think it was supernatural. But after a while, that novelty wore off, and there was a series of revolts. And then when you look at Cortez himself, it's very hard to see how he did it. I mean, he's pulled down from horses. He's clubbed. He's surrounded. He's got people trying within his own circle and cadre trying to kill him, to assassinate him. He's got Native American allies that decide to change sides, and they almost wipe him out. He has the idea of ships. He has to build them. I mean, there's nothing the guy can't do, whatever you think about his morality. And then he ends up very badly in his late 50s. He's sort of stripped of all of his conquest, the spoils of war, so to speak. He goes back to Spain. There's a lot of anger and dissension and disagreement about his legacy among the Spaniards themselves, especially the Catholic Church. There's fights between his heirs about which property is which. And he ends up not a very happy, healthy, or well person. He dies in Spain in his early 60s. When I reference the Aztecs as a professor, if I do, people have no idea what they were about. They were very sophisticated in terms of astronomy and architecture and engineering, but there were somewhere between 25,000 to 40,000 human sacrifices a year, as well as ritual cannibalism. Institutionalized. And that's the only reason Cortez won, because when he invaded from 1519 to 1521, he had the help of the Tlaxcalans and other allies, and they didn't want to help these foreign barbarians. They helped them because they thought they had the ability to dethrone the Aztecs that were harvesting tens of thousands of their population every year in these so-called flower wars. But nobody knows about that. They don't teach that in the universities. The misfortune of the Aztecs were that they didn't meet the pilgrims. What I mean by that is, if you look at patterns of colonization, North American colonization had families, and they were, in many cases, Protestant refugees, and they were not military people that were going to the East Coast of the United States. If you look at the patterns of immigration from northern Mexico to Chile and include the Caribbean, it was largely a monopoly of only people could immigrate with the permission of the Catholic and Spanish government. In other words, if you wanted to go and take your family and you wanted to move to the coast of Colombia or something, you had to get a permission from the Spanish government. And that was not given to you unless you were a subject of the Spanish Empire or were given some kind of quasi-citizenship and you were Catholic. Problem here was that Spain, 1492 Columbus to 1521, Cortez take, and then the Incas up into the 1550s with Pizarro. This was a culture that had been doing what? It had been fighting religious wars nonstop, and would be fighting religious wars nonstop with the Protestant Reformation. But more importantly, it had just come out of the Reconquista. So when you look at Spanish conquistadors who went to the New World, you're talking about people who ancestors or grandparents, they had been fighting for 200 years, fighting to unify Spanish speakers and reclaim the Iberian Peninsula from Muslims. And they had been fighting in North Africa. And they had been a new threat called Protestantism. So when you unleash those people to colonial indigenous people, they were not there to get mom and dad and grandpa and get in a wagon and go on 40 acres. They were there for God and glory and gold. The Spanish Empire in 1500 was at its zenith. It was just starting to get huge amounts of silver and gold bullion from the New World. But more importantly, if you look at military technology and what was coming out of Toledo, Spain, as far as the quality of, it had been from Roman times, the quality of steel swords, or you look at the tercio, the Spanish phalanx formation, or you look at the quality of Spanish breastplates, and you look at all the way into the 16th, 17th century, and you look at Don Juan, at Lepanto, 1571, the Duke of Santa Cruz, those people won the Battle of Lepanto. They were very, very fierce fighters, is what I'm trying to say. They really did believe. They believed that Christianity was the savior of mankind, and it was threatened on various fronts. It was threatened by apostates within the church called Protestants. It was threatened by Islam, and the only way it was going to survive is to conquer people and convert people and win souls. What I'm getting at is people are still baffled how Cortez, his army shrank and increased over that 2.5 year period, but it was never larger than 1,500 people. So how did 1,500 people destroy an empire of 4 million? And part of the answer was the Tlaxcalans. And what I'm getting at is there's no San Diego State Tlaxcalans, is there? I had a lot of Mexican-American students, and they were very interested in the Aztecs. And every time I would say to them, why aren't you interested in the Tlaxcalans? Because the Tlaxcalans were brutalized by the Aztecs and fought back and destroyed it.
if you look at any of the contemporary chroniclers, the problem that Cortez had when he unleashed the Tlaxcalans in those last days of the fall of Tenochtitlan, he couldn't restrain them. They wiped out. One of the reasons there were no more Aztecs wasn't just the destruction of the capital city and Cortez, but it was the Tlaxcalans took an enormous revenge on them. They were promised special concessions under the new Spanish control of the Mexica. The Aztecs were known as the Aztecs. They were called Mexica.
I'm Mark Vinette, and I hope you're enjoying the ride. The Historical Jesus Podcast is the sweeping saga of the life and times of Galilean Jesus of Nazareth, as well as the faith, religion, and church founded to honor and disseminate his acts and teachings. Join me, Mark Vinette, on this fascinating journey through time, exploring the many great works of Christian theology, literature, architecture, music, and art, inspired by the words and deeds of Jesus Christ.